Bridgebank helps breakthrough ideas actually break through and remains dedicated to providing financial solutions to those committed to leveraging innovation to make the world a better place. Bridgebank, a division of Western Alliance Bank. Bridgebank, be bold, venture wisely.
Hey, it's Avery Trufelman, host of Articles of Interest, and I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid, and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
From KQED. Hey everyone, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. And today on The Breakdown, just one day after the historic inauguration of President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris, still getting my head around that one, we're going to talk to someone who's got experience in both Washington and back here in California.
I know, it's kind of crazy, right, Scott?
A little crazy.
Vice President.
More than a little.
Yeah, well, today, as Biden attempts to bring down the heat in Washington and reconstitute some of the norms his predecessor blew up, including the daily White House press briefing, we have a guest who knows that briefing room up close. She was the first woman to hold that position about 30 years ago, or exactly 30 years
30
ago.
Years ago. My goodness. Dee Dee Myers is here. Oh, here she is. She's already giving a briefing. Hold on. She's longtime communications expert and recently named by Governor Gavin Newsom as the top economic advisor. Welcome to The Breakdown, Dee Dee.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Scott and Marisa. It's good to be here.
We're very happy to have you.
Was it not 30 years ago? My math is probably wrong.
Yeah, your math is wrong. It was 1993, so it's 28 years ago.
28.
You're close.
Yeah. I'm a journalist for a reason.
And you worked on the campaign. That was almost
it's correct.
3 decades-ish. Well, yeah. As we mentioned, and actually right before we started taping, they had another one. But, you know, yesterday we saw the first press briefing with Press Secretary Jen Psaki. She said she'd be restarting this daily tradition. And I just wonder what you think, having been in that position, like how important is that? This is not something the Trump administration did throughout their presidency.
I think it's really important in a number of ways. And look, I think, and I've actually talked to Jen about this. Jen is a fantastic professional who's, you know, been at this, knows what she's doing. But I think the briefing just in general is a really important tool for two things. One, for the administration to communicate its views to the American public through the press, and for the press to ask questions. It is important for the Fourth Estate to hold power accountable, and that should be a dialogue. And as you know, having served in that position, you both provide information, but you also get a lot of good feedback too from reporters, not only in sort of holding your feet to the fire about being consistent and connecting the dots between what you said yesterday and what you're going to say tomorrow, but you take that information back inside the White House, and it helps both provide transparency, it helps shape not so much policy, sometimes, what the reaction is in the outside world. And I think that dialogue is important. Now, the briefing can be a bit of performance art, as we've all seen, but nonetheless, I think it serves a purpose. And the most important thing about reestablishing this briefing is that the person behind the podium, most days Jen Psaki, will actually tell the truth and will deal in facts. And whole new thing.
I want to ask you about that because, yes, we all remember Sean Spicer on day one arguing about the size of the inaugural crowd and insisting it was bigger than Obama's. And I think we were all like, what is going on here? But, as you said, Jen Psaki promised to always tell the truth. She may not have used that exact phrase, but, that's not always exactly possible, is it? Because either you don't have all the information because you weren't given it, and sometimes because of national security or other reasons, you have to kind of bend the truth a little bit.
Well, no, I think you have to be very careful of ever doing that. You don't have to tell the whole truth, right? You don't have to tell everything you know. And there may be things that you can't say publicly, or there are often things that you don't know. I mean, one person can't know everything, even if you interact with the president regularly and the senior leadership regularly, which press secretaries do. But you can always be sure that to the best of your ability, to the very best of your ability, that what you do say is true. And that's really important. So, you know, there's a million ways to work around that. You can say, I can't share that with you. You can say, I'll get back to you on that. You can say, that's classified. There's a lot of things that you can say that don't require you to say, the president's crowd was bigger than President Obama's, when everyone in the world can see the corresponding photos and judge for themselves. Or, you know, provide misinformation even by, and I think that you have to be careful to be true in implication as well as in fact. So you can't, you know, imply, lead people to believe things that aren't true. You know, sometimes that happens by accident. It's not intentional. If it's intentional, then you are corroding the currency of your role, which is the truth.
Right. And I think on the other hand, you know, reporters have to worry about their own currency, which is being truthful and their reputation and being seen to hold power to account regardless of party. But this is such a weird moment, right? After how just nasty the relationship was between the president calling, you know, us the enemy of the people and a lot of his supporters kind of parroting that. And we often hear Republicans complain that, like, the media goes easier on Democrats. And I'm just curious, like, what you think of that allegation and how you think reporters should be handling this, because, you know, it's not our job to root for Joe Biden or to support him. Right. It is our job to hold him to account as well.
Right. I think that is the reputation, right? Journalists are, they're Democrats or they're left leaning. They're easier on other Democrats. If you ask any president who's ever held the office, they will tell you uniformly, this is the one thing that they all agree on. They all hate the press and think they got the harshest, most unfair, most biased treatment of any president in the history of the republic.
Maybe governors too. Maybe governors too.
I remember a mayor who thought that.
Some governors have been known to feel that way, you know. Yeah. But and I just think that comes a little bit with the territory, right? It's everything you do is questioned. And look, that's hard. It's exhausting, but it comes with the territory. So I think that journalists have to do that role. Like, you cannot have a free society without a free press. I'm a firm believer in that. That said, I think one of the things that's, you know, increased the kind of animosity between any White House of any party and the press is that there's a lot of headline grabbing, scandal, you know, searching, click baiting that goes on. And stories about, you know, interpersonal crises and scandals are a lot more interesting to the readers or the listeners, the viewers, than a complex analysis of a policy in the wake of a pandemic, you know. So that tension is just built in.
Well, and you had your more than your share of that working for Bill Clinton. That's maybe a good transition back to the campaign and to his to the White House. You were the first woman, as Marisa said, to hold that job. And I'm wondering, you know, how do you think that affected your ability to do your job and how you were treated differently?
Yeah, you know, 30 years ago, there hadn't been a lot of women behind those podiums, right, in the State Department or at the White House or the other, you know, the Defense Department. And so I was three things. I was young. I was 31. I was the first woman, and I was from California, right? So that's kind of the trifecta of how not to show up, because it was harder for me to establish my authority. I was just young, and I wasn't of Washington, and I was a woman, and that all these things were different.
Is there something particularly about California?
Yeah, you know, they literally, people said to me in the briefing room, the country tilts to the left, and all the nuts and fruits roll downhill. So there was this kind of idea, and I think it still exists, by the way, that California is a remote land of people with different ideas. And I would say that, yeah, and those ideas will be yours in 10 years, so pay attention. Right? But nonetheless, so I do think that was it was a bit of an exotic, like, creature, and establishing, again, authority was challenging. I don't think that's true at all anymore. I think, I guess besides Scott, President Trump only had women, right, representing him. Dana Perino worked for President Bush. Mm-hmm. You've now seen a number of the Trump press secretaries, and now Jen Psaki comes at it with so much experience and so much poise. And we've seen her 2 days now, and she's been fantastic.
What about, though, just if I could just ask a quick follow, because that was sort of like the outside perception, but inside the White House, you had problems because you were a first woman, too, didn't you?
I think they were the same problems. I think I was young and I was female and I was from California, although I had come from the campaign, so that was helpful because I had spent a lot of time with Governor Clinton and then President Clinton, and so I had a good relationship with him, which is always helpful in that role. But there were some other structural problems, and there was a lot of people dipping into the communications lane sort of being able to get my arms around that and manage it and speak with authority was challenging. It got better as time went on, but it took a lot of work. I think, this White House, one of the things that's so interesting about the Clinton transition and early days was there had only been 4 years of a Democratic president in the previous 24 years. And that was the Carter presidency. And that at the time was looked upon as a not very successful presidency. And so there weren't a lot of people around who had the jobs, right, and had the experience and that came to it the way that this White House has people who have, served in two previous Democratic administrations. Many of them have been through this, have been through transitions, have stood up White Houses, have sort of figured out structures, and so it really is refreshing to see how experienced and how they can hit the ground running on day one. That wasn't exactly my experience.
Yeah, they know where all the secret bathrooms are and the names of the people in the press, right? Which is like that relationship matters. I mean, to Scott's point, some of the stories looking back, and I was struck by you saying, you were young and a woman, and I remember feeling, especially in my 20s, like who knows, is this gender or age bias? Like you don't always know.
It all gets wrapped together.
Yeah, but you left after a couple of years, and there was a lot of stories at the time about how maybe you didn't have as much access to the president. I'm curious, like, if you want to talk about that, fine, but more just like, how important is that the person representing the president at that podium does have his or her ear whenever, or not whenever they want, but regularly?
It's really important. I mean, it's really important to be able to go out there with both the confidence that you know what the president is thinking and with the ability to say so, right? Because I think the press is skeptical. They want you guys, all of y'all, want to be in the room from the minute he wakes up, and puts on his socks, the minute he shuts off the light at night, and know everything he's doing. And you want to make sure that whoever the narrator is knows what's going on. And I think that's a fair requirement. I had, relatively good access to the president throughout. But there was a lot of other decision making that was harder for me because there were so many people in the lane. And, when I first came, President Clinton had made a commitment, which was to have an administration that looked like America. And as he got further into it, the women's groups were rightly protesting that there weren't enough women. And so one of the solutions to that was to make me the press secretary, but to give me a lower rank and a smaller office than my predecessors, right? In the first couple of months, George Stephanopoulos did the daily briefing. So those added to my woes, and it took me a long time to fight back from that and to reestablish the credibility of the press secretary. I was more successful in some aspects than others. It's a longer story. I'm happy to share it with you guys someday. But I think all of it underscored that's important, not just to the press secretary. It's not just to make my life easier. It's important to the president and to the relationship between the White House and the public, right? To know that there's reliable information and that person is really speaking on behalf of the president.
Which, like, the press secretary is representing the White House to the public, and the press is helping get that message out. We're going to have to take a short break now. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with veteran communications expert and Gavin Newsom advisor Dee Dee Myers. You are listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hi there, I'm Rund Abdelfattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer. And today we are talking to Dede Meyers. She was White House press secretary under President Clinton and now leads California's Office of Business and Economic Development, advising Governor Gavin Newsom. So, Dede, as we've been detailing, you have a lot of experience in communications, but you've been called in to help really restart this economy that's been suffering under the pandemic. What is your charge and why do you think the governor hired you in this role?
Well, that's an excellent question. I actually have spent a lot of time in the last decade or so in the private sector. In fact, I spent most of the time since I left the White House in the private sector, working with businesses as a consultant and then at Warner Brothers as a member of the executive committee and on corporate boards. And so I've certainly spent a lot of time dealing with, you know, business issues and economic issues. Although, you know, I'm more known as a communicator, which I continue to be. So this summer, I was volunteering. I had left Warner Brothers last spring and started volunteering, you know, Anne O'Leary, who was then president, I mean, Governor Newsom's chief of staff, asked me if I would come help. Just there, obviously, was a lot going on between the pandemic and the economic slowdown and everything else. And so I happily came in as a volunteer. And among other things, I worked with the governor's task force on business and jobs recovery. And one thing led to another. And he asked if I would come on in this role, which was vacant. So I felt like it was a good time to, you know, put my shoulder to the wheel and help the state recover from everything that's going on.
You know, it's interesting. You were recounting earlier how other people kind of got into your lane of communication when you were at the White House. And I would think that now that is your expertise, even though it's not your job, because the vacancy was with the agency. And so how are you going to stay in your lane? And I would wonder, given like French Laundry and all these other problems the governor is confronting, possible recall, he might just kind of want to lure you over into the communications office.
Well, you know, it's like hard to escape your past completely. And I am a senior advisor to the governor and the director of the Office of Economic Business and Economic Development. So I think the intention was always that I would spend a little bit of time helping, because communicating with the public is a really important part of what any leader does. It's not my full-time day-to-day job. There are certainly other people that do that. Sahar Robertson, you know, who's there. Roberts is great. So, but I do try to be helpful, and I think it's important for him to communicate certainly his message to businesses and to workers about what's happening in the economy and how we are investing in economic recovery and how you know, we want to build back an economy that's stronger, fairer, prosperous for all Californians. And so that's obviously a huge communications component. There's the work, but there's also talking about the work and sharing the work. And so that part of it obviously comes pretty naturally to me as well.
I mean, we spent the top half really talking about the press relationship with the White House. And I'm curious, coming into Sacramento, I mean, you know, Governor Gavin Newsom likes to talk. He likes to communicate quite a bit. we've both covered him since he was mayor. I always tell the story of, you know, him coming in with his like 2-8 folders of matrix of accountability and just like filibustering an entire, you know, meeting with reporters because he just goes and goes. I mean, are you talking to him about that at all? And like, because I think the knock is from a substantive perspective that sometimes he overpromises and underdelivers. And, you know, we've seen a lot of talking during this crisis, but California's not doing great when it comes to COVID response, the same way many states aren't.
I don't think any states are doing great. I mean, there's some states that have you know, it's been a little bit cyclical, right? So New York got it early. We got it early. Well, we avoided getting it early. Well, we all know the trajectory, right? And I live in Los Angeles, and obviously we've just found out that we had a more, you know, contagious strain of the virus. That's one of the reasons that we've probably seen such numbers here. But that said, it's a very difficult and unprecedented job. And so I do think communicating about that and sharing with the public, you know, here's what we're seeing, here's what we're doing. And yeah, the governor, I mean, he likes, you know, he's a full, you know, he likes to give a full description of what he's doing and what he's thinking. And, you know, everybody brings theirself to their job, right? And so I think that's just one of the ways that he manages. He's pretty darn good at it, actually. He's very articulate and he's very smart. And, you know, he remembers a lot of information, as, you know, as he's talked publicly about. He has dyslexia, and so he memorizes a lot of stuff, which has been really impressive to watch and see how much information he's able to absorb and then re-communicate to all of you. So,
well, let me tell you what else I memorized. But I want to ask you about the vaccine stuff, because I think, as you said when you first took on this job, that that's really going to be the most important thing. We're hearing that from the Biden administration as well. And yet, you know, the governor likes to say that California is coming attractions for the rest of the country. And yet we are at or near the bottom of the percentage of vaccines we have that have been put in the arms of people, which is really seems to me inexcusable. That's not a communications problem.
Right. Absolutely not. And that's something we communicators often say, is this is, you know, it's, this is not about telling the story. Although I do think one of the issues, and I think the short bottom line, we have to do better. We absolutely have to do better. We have, you know, we have a very big state. We've got 30 million people that are going to be vaccine eligible. We need to get them. That's 60 million doses. That is a huge lift. We have a complex system in that the counties here have more authority over health issues than they do in many other parts of the country. And so we have to manage around that, but we have to do it. And we have to do it, you know, better than we've done so far. And I think we're making fixes every day. And we absolutely have to get there. We owe it to the people of California, right? And we need to get through this pandemic. And the only way we're going to get through it is if, you know, the majority of Californians are vaccinated. And that includes communicating about why it's important to get vaccinated and why people need to do that, because we've seen some vaccine hesitancy. Now, that said and owned, the biggest challenge to getting to the big numbers, right, getting 30 million people vaccinated, is going to be the supply of vaccines coming in. And as we know, that's a huge problem, bigger problem than we thought. I am grateful that the Biden administration is there and they're going to come up with a national plan, and they're going to, you know, use all the tools at their disposal to help states get the resources and the doses that we need to get the job done. And then it's on us. You know, it's on us. And, you know, we'll know. I think one of the things that, too, that the numbers look maybe a little bit worse than they are, because there's a bit of a delay in processing and reporting information given the complex structure. But we got to fix that, too.
Well, let's talk about the broader business climate. I mean, the story that repeats every like 5 to 8 years is like, California's done. Everyone's leaving. Elon Musk is taking his toys and going to Texas. Is this overblown? And if so, why? I mean, your predecessor had a pretty fiery Twitter thread about this week, that the New York Times kind of drops somebody in every once in a while and writes our obituary, but we're not going anywhere. So do you agree with that?
I mean, you know, having lived a lot of my life on the East Coast, it was like, okay, wait for it. Here comes the California's over. So, oh, there it goes. Got it.
Right. San Francisco, too. We like to do that.
Yeah. And San Francisco's the particular target, right? And my husband is a journalist, and he always says, in journalism, three is a trend, right? So you get three companies that are leaving, and all of a sudden, you know, you have Oracle, you have Elon, and you have HP. And, yeah, so it's a trend. But look, I say that I do think it's overblown, but I do think we ignore the warning signs at our own peril, right? There are complexities to doing business in California, and it's on us to work with the business community to address those.
And, you know, I want to talk about the tech industry a little more detail, because both Republicans and Democrats are angry in some ways for different reasons with the tech industry, whether it's Uber and Lyft and organized labor, or Twitter and Facebook and the Republicans feeling censored. How do you see California needing to strike the balance and the governor having to strike the balance? He was pretty neutral, for example, on AB 5 and on the ballot measure Prop 22. I think he actually took a position on that, which, you know, kind of pitted him between Uber and Lyft and organized labor.
Right. He signed 85, but he didn't take a position on 22 because he thought whatever happened, we would need to resolve some of the work around the edges in the aftermath. And so wanted to be able to be a honest broker on that. And here we are. Look, I mean, tech, there are unintended consequences, right, in all kinds of facets of life and business. And I think we're seeing, you know, there are a couple of different strains, right? Gig workers versus the information economy and the just profound effect that President Trump's Twitter account had on the world, the profound effect. So I don't have a good answer on that, but I do think that, you know, the tech is a broad term. I'm not sure that you can easily pin down what does it mean, right? There's biotech that's going to solve, you know, a lot of health issues and create, you know, healthier lives for people. And then there's information technology that will have all kinds of applications that we can't even think of. And there is, you know, the ongoing evolution of the gig economy and how people work, and then what the implications of that are for the quality of jobs and the quality of life for people who work in those jobs. And so those are all issues that we're going to be dealing with for the rest of our lives, for sure, trying to figure out how do we deal with the unintended consequences, sometimes that are good problems, like it's created a lot of wealth for a lot of people, and then that drives up the cost of housing in the Valley and in San Francisco and in places like that. So an ongoing problem. I think the thing, though, that we can't lose sight of is that California's probably greatest strength is the innovation economy, mm-hmm. right? And it's across the board. It's aerospace and logistics and transportation and the technology and all these different things. This is a very innovative place. And one of the satisfying things of the last, there's been many satisfying things for me in the last few days, but one of them is to see how the Biden administration is looking to California for ideas on things like clean energy and, zero emissions vehicles and clean fuel, and on social issues as well. And so the state will provide a leadership position because we've been dealing with these issues. Like I said, you know, wait 10 years and you guys will all be talking about what we were talking about. And so that, you know, it's not that we've resolved everything, but we're dealing with problems, challenges that are created by this innovation economy. And I think many parts of the country, as we see, as they're trying to steal our companies, right. They want what we have. And we're not going to give it up without a fight.
So we like to end on a fun note. And when Scott, when we found out that we got you for the show, our producer dug up some San Francisco Chronicle stories from a mayoral campaign where you and Scott were actually sparring as press secretaries for opposing candidates.
I don't even know if you remember, Dee Dee, but I was working for Art Agnos.
That was the craziest campaign I've ever worked on. My life by a lot.
Well, is it my fight in a phone booth? Is what David Chu says, right?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
You had come off of the Feinstein for governor campaign, which, you know, she lost, I think, right? And then you got hired. And I remember the Agnos campaign where I was working. He said, "Oh no, they hired Dee Dee Myers. She's really good." but you know, Frank Jordan, not the best candidate necessarily, and certainly not the best mayor.
He was a good man.
Diplomatic, Dee Dee Myers.
He's a good man. Art had not been particularly nice to Dianne Feinstein.
And we know she has a long memory.
Yeah, every time I see her, she reminds me.
That was a little bit,
is that payback?
Saying you're welcome or thank you, Mr. Agnos, who's also, I'm sure, a fine man. But, you know, I went from that campaign, as you well recall, there was a runoff, right? Ended on a Tuesday. I got on a plane on Friday and flew to Orlando, Florida to get on the Clinton campaign plane.
That's funny because I went to the EDD that day, I think.
So you, no rest for the weary there.
A lot of losing campaigns in my background.
Well, and then the other thing we didn't hit, which is what I want to talk about, which is that you advised The West Wing, which I just rewatched, and I encourage people to go check it out again. Yeah. It was must have been fun.
That was a fantastic experience. It was just a lot. I mean, it was just a really great group of people that are still close to each other, and I'm fortunate to still keep in somewhat touch with them. Aaron Sorkin's obviously a genius and has gone on to do incredible things and will continue to do incredible things. And it was just a fun way to tell the story of what the White House should be and, you know, what the kind of, you know, it's more than a romantic vision. Anyway, yeah. it was great. It was a wonderful experience, and I'm glad you guys have enjoyed and continue.
Well, thank you, Dee Dee Myers. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you so
much. Happy to be with you.
That's going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We are a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati, engineer Katie McMurrin. I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at MLagos. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mind Shift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond, with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.